Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
The children of Chernobyl, looking at the legacy of the world's worst nuclear disaster, will hear an amazing story of hope. And you might be surprised to learn who harvests most of the world's staple crops, but they don't have much say in the way the world's natural resources are managed. Hello and welcome. Those are the stories we'll be hearing on today's program. I'm Tracy McClure. Back in April 1986, I was here in Italy when the world's worst nuclear accident sent shockwaves of fear across Europe. Nuclear reactor number 4 at Chernobyl in what is today Ukraine exploded on April 26, 1986. Radiation spewed over a huge swath of the former Soviet Union and much of Northern Europe. But winds and rain brought clouds of radioactive material as far south as Rome and even other parts of Italy. News reports forecasted gloom and doom. We were told to avoid eating vegetables, especially the leafy kinds, and many fruits, and to stop drinking milk and eating meat from affected regions. The crisis lasted weeks. But in Chernobyl itself and the hardest hit areas in Ukraine, Western Russia, and Belarus, which suffered up to 70% of the damage, the emergency never went away. A larger and stronger shelter is being built to cover the ruins of the Soviet power plant to prevent further radiation leaks. But the contamination is massive just the same, and it's here to stay. Chernobyl Children's Project International is an organization that provides medical help and assistance to children who continue to suffer the aftermath of the disaster. Director Adi Roche is passionate about her work, which she took up after hearing a desperate plea from Belarus and Ukrainian doctors to help get the children out of the contaminated areas so their bodies could have some chance for recovery.
It is the children who are paying the highest price because there is so much genetic damage passing down the line. Like, we're being told that it's a demographic disaster, that 22 years on, we will only now see the first generation down of Chernobyl victims.
Adi founded the organization to provide recuperating holidays for Chernobyl children to visit with families in other countries, namely her native Ireland. Adi says that what had started out as providing Chernobyl kids a home away from home in the back bedroom of her house has now become a full-fledged international organization offering comprehensive aid programs and sustainable development projects that are making a real and a lasting difference. She spoke to Irene Lagan after returning from a recent trip to Chernobyl. She says we must keep the collective memory alive so that what happened that fateful day in April 1986 will never happen again.
I think it's only if we take a look back and analyze and assess and listen to the stories and listen to the grief, listen to the suffering, that can we in any way understand the picture of the life that has been created since that time for the current generations in order that we may learn for the future. And in a way, because we have no template of anything happening in this scale before in the history of humanity, there is no other catastrophe, no matter what you care to mention, that has happened in our time of evolution over millions and billions of years. Nothing compares to this. So in a sense, we almost need a new eye, a new heart, a new courage, a new strength to be open to a new kind of war. And this is a war in which you cannot see the enemy. There is no antidote you can use. There is no weapon. There is no standing army. There is no safe haven or sanctuary for the most vulnerable, the pregnant women, the children, the elderly, the sick. In this war, the enemy is invisible. And I have just come back from what I call the front line, the battle zone, down in the heart of the Chernobyl disaster, where we're seeing 22 years on the death of 3,000 towns and villages, which are now left almost as a silent graveyard or monument to man's greatest folly. And then we spent our time with the film crew from Ireland going around visiting the casualties in hospitals, in orphanages, in mental asylums, in poor villages. And these are the people that are left languishing in their misery, particularly the children. Children who were born with thyroid abnormalities, children born with very damaged hearts, children born with very damaged immune systems, ensuring that they have no ability to fight off ordinary infections and ordinary illnesses, children who are born with a huge range of birth deformities, a huge increases in hydrocephalic children, in children born with cerebral palsy, children being born with Down syndrome. All conditions that existed previously but are there in huge numbers. And I witnessed, and I mean, I really think that we are there to make a testimony, to bear witness to those who are suffering, because these people feel they have no voice. They feel that the world has cut them off. They feel paralyzed. They feel numbed by what has happened, and they feel that the world has most of all forgotten them. And this lifeline is coming from Italy because people in Italy love family, love children. It's coming from Ireland because we have an equally strong ethos on family and on responsibility and conscience to one another. And only for us, those few countries, the rest of the world has forgotten this tragedy. And what we're trying to say is, every child is precious, every life is a gift, and every life deserves to be allowed to live out its hopes, its dreams, its aspirations, even when they're unable to communicate physically or emotionally or mentally, children who are locked within their own bodies. And these children are an inspiration to us. And they are the ones that are sustaining us 20 years on, saying, not in their name, because we have to be able to say, like, these are the children who are currently suffering, but let's, in the name of future generations, the children that have yet to be born, that we're going to say, not in their name, because this planet of ours is an incredible miracle of life. It could have been just another barren planet in the galaxy of the Milky Way. But our Creator has given us the gift of life, this extraordinary ability to live and to produce life. And we need to repay that gift by protecting it for future generations. And in a sense, that is our task today, to remember that, to commemorate that, to mark that, and to also recognize that we can celebrate that gift of life, because through the power of our intervention, we can make such a massive difference by giving these children sanctuary, by giving these children hope to hope. And Victor Hugo, the French philosopher, once said that the word that God has written on the brow of every man is the word hope. And to me, hope is the most enabling gift of all. And that is what we try and give to the children today.
One generation has passed, essentially, since the disaster. Yes. So these children that are born are still born with current defects. And is there a memory of what has taken place?
That's a very interesting question, because I suppose sometimes in our not realizing it, but probably something that happens through our own socialization process, we almost forget that no matter how disabled physically or mentally a child is or a young adult, that they have huge sensitivities and great thoughts themselves. And it's interesting that you should raise this issue of how much consciousness of this do they have. And I honestly believe absolutely they are completely conscious. Even the children that are so disabled mentally and physically that all they can communicate through is their eyes. And I really believe that the eyes are the old saying of the windows of the soul. And so many stories have come to light to us through the eyes of children. And I'm just thinking of a little boy that I came across in a home for abandoned babies, a little boy who was kept in a straitjacket. This is over 12 years ago. And he only had one eye because on the other side of his face was a massive tumor. And I remember being so disturbed because, I mean, his tumor was oozing and smelling. And he was 4 months old. And he, with that eye, he kept on drawing us back to his little cot, to his little prison. And I felt that his eye spoke to us at 4 months old, unable to do anything with his hands, his feet, nothing. And I felt that what he was communicating, this was Christmas week, I felt he was communicating, save my life, because he was dying. And we actually airlifted him 2 days after Christmas on the Russian Orthodox Christmas Day, a few days actually, it was just in early January in the Feast of the Epiphany, that we actually airlifted that boy out for life-saving treatment. And now that boy is 12 years of age and my sister adopted him and he has just made his confirmation and he is my godchild. He is one witness to the power of the human ability to communicate, even though we were told at the time that this boy was brain dead. We were told that to let him die. And I said, no, where there's life, there's hope. With an Irish film crew for Irish television, we filmed two young adults, 18 years of age, in a mental asylum. And their only crime was that they had survived to the age of 18, because most of them die. And they begged us not to put them into what's a semi-prison, home for demented elderly people, not to put them in there. And we have sat down with them and they actually told us how they see themselves as being survivors and victims of Chernobyl. We had never even asked them in all of these 18 years that I know these young men, we had never even asked them, what did they know? What was their awareness or their understanding? And finally, these boys spoke and they said, we want a life. We want, one of them said, I want to be an artist. The other guy said, I want to be a philosopher. I want to be a writer. I just said, my God, what is locked within the minds of these young adults left languishing in these places. And as a result of their plea, we've got, for the first time in the history of Belarus, we've actually got the right for these two young men to have their freedom. We're going to try and set them up to live independent lives and let them become dreamers, philosophers, writers, singers, whatever it is they want to do, because every child deserves to have that vision, that hope, that dream of what they can be, so that they can reach for the stars, and whatever they achieve, that it is an achievement to be celebrated. And I think it's so important that these people are not dismissed. I mean, the world has forgotten little Belarus, northern Ukraine and western Russia, because so many other tragedies have come to our television screens, the tragedies of famine, the tragedies of war. But what we forget is that no matter how bad or protracted a war is or a famine, there is a beginning, middle and end. It is down to the negotiators, to the politicians, to have the wherewithal and the intelligence and the belief that they can find a resolution to the conflict. But with Chernobyl, there is a beginning, but there is no end, because of the genetic damage for what we have created in humankind, but also in the flora and fauna. Because I was working with scientists who were taking soil samples, food samples in the soil, and they were telling us that it's now locked in the top 5 centimetres of topsoil, and that's where the roots of plants and vegetables get their source of energy from to grow. It's where the livestock get their food, their grass to eat, and then it gets right back into the food chain. This will be there for the rest of time, so we need to take stock and say to ourselves, is this the legacy we leave to our children? And I praise God that the answer is absolutely no, that in the name of future generations that we will have the courage and the strength to look to the God-given sources of energy that are there in abundance, just waiting for us to tap into them, and that that is the way forward. Solar energy, energy efficient technology and energy management. And if everybody makes that commitment, boy, can we change the world.
Adi Roche is founding director of Chernobyl Children's Project International. You can find out more about Adi and her work and about how you might be able to help by logging on to her website. That's Chernobyl-International.com. Next time you're digging into a bowl of rice, think about this. Women were probably the ones to produce that rice, especially if it comes from Asia. Women are the main producers of staple foods such as rice, wheat, and maize in the world's poorest regions. In fact, women in rural areas across the globe are responsible for more than half of the planet's food production. and that figure jumps to 70% in most countries in the developing world. Working the fields for generations, women also possess vast knowledge about indigenous farming techniques, genetic diversity, seeds and foods and medicines from forests and plants. But to what extent are women consulted, or even considered, in development strategies? One non-governmental organization says women are not involved enough in the development of sustainable agricultural management. WOCAM, Women Organizing for Change in Agriculture and Natural Resource Management, says not all approaches to development are in the best interests of women. And that's because few women are part of the decision-making process. Jeanette Gurung is director of WOCAM. She spoke to Lucas Duran.
We are a global network, international network, of about 510 members of women and men in about 80 countries of the world. All of our members are professionals who work in agriculture, forestry, livestock, fisheries, etc., and people who have a strong interest in gender equality. WOCAM is a women-led organization in the natural resource management field, and that makes it quite unique. Both agriculture and natural resource management sectors are traditionally and still very dominated by males, and a male perspective on the world, and a male's a way that's more comfortable for men than women to work in. So what's happened is there are a number of us, I'm a forester by profession, who study these fields thinking that we're, number one, equal to men. And then 20 years later, we realize that the men are in positions of decision-making power and authority when we are often not. So in a career progression, women are very much disadvantaged in these organizations. But the more important reason is that many women in the developing countries study these sectors of agriculture and forestry in order to help poor rural women farmers. And by being in such low positions inside the organizations, they do not have the power to affect the decisions related to getting resources and services to be of advantage and benefit to rural women farmers.
Which are the main objectives?
Number one is, I would say, to build women's leadership. We have seen very much that women who work in these sectors are often without the confidence, without the skills on how to influence processes of change inside their own organizations and their own communities. Number two, and this is very important for WOCAM, is we believe that the organizations themselves need to change dramatically in order for us to have a sustainable support to women farmers. We think there's not much long-term good in simply trying to deliver services directly to women farmers on a short-term basis. The institutions such as the government departments of agriculture, livestock, forestry, these are the institutions and NGOs that need to change so that they are accountable to women farmers and delivering services. So WOCAM's work very much focuses on organizational change for gender equality.
But how?
We have seen again and again that when individual women and men have the idea of change, have the strength of conviction, have a network of allies, and some skills in how to influence change inside their organization, they can do it. They cannot do it alone. They need at least a few other colleagues that they need around them who understand the issues, who are willing and committed to make the change. And they need, of course, some financial support to give them some power and authority. And they need an outside group of allies who can push strategically to affect the process of change. So we identify partner agencies around the world through projects. We then have a course we give training on gender and organizational change. with a few of the people from inside those organizations who we train as change agents. They know best. They're inside of their organization. They understand the culture of the organization, the mandate, the policies, the ways of working. They are the ones who need to bring about the change. And so we partner with them. We offer capacity building, training workshop, key little bits of strategic funding. They prepare an action plan and we mentor them and support them to fulfill.
Who finances this kind of action?
So far, we've had support from IFAD, who's been a very key donor of ours right from the beginning. We've also had some support from Canadian CEDA, from IDRC, which is a Canadian-funded development research organization. Some support from FAO in small ways as well. But we're hoping that we can significantly increase these resources. Also, I would like to say, because now the hot burning issue is that of climate change, and women and gender issues as related to climate change is so far not been given very much attention at all, although we have a lot of data that show that women will be more impacted negatively by climate change than men, and women are also in a unique position, we believe, to positively address issues of climate change, etc. But again, we must change the organizations that are going to channel the funds for climate change and carbon financing so that they understand this very important role of women as farmers and as natural resource managers.
You are a very young organization network. Which are the main problems you find in your everyday action?
We've almost grown so quickly that in a way it's the danger is, of course, that we our ideals, our ambitions grow faster than our capacity to address the issues is. We are small. The funding is difficult to get to pay for personnel. The funding is often targeted towards projects at the developing country level and at the institutional level, and no one ever wants to pay for the coordination of those inputs, which is quite a big task. Our answer to this, I mean, again, members in 80 countries, how do you engage these members who are all so very keen and anxious to volunteer and help? Our answer to this has been to hold what we call regional meetings of members. We held our first one in Cameroon for Western and Central African members. We bring together women members and only women because we find that women speak honestly when they're all together alone without men. For 4 days, they start to reflect on what it means to be a woman in a male-dominated organization. They come together with great energy and enthusiasm. They form a kind of a collective action plan, and then we try to obtain some funding to help realize some of the action plan ideas they have. We've done it for West and Central Africa. We will be doing it for Eastern and Southern Africa in a meeting in Uganda. Then following that, we'll do it again for South Asia. It's a way we become face-to-face, we get to know our members and try to see who's the most interested and what can be done on the ground.
What can be the contribution then that men can give to the organization, to the work?
This, we feel, is a very important question, and we feel this is a very unique part of Wokan. It's just not possible to get anything done substantially without men. And we recognize that much of the gender equality agenda in the past has been framed by a feminist perspective, which is nothing wrong with that, but it leaves very little space for men to be able to understand how to engage in this. And we know so many men who are extremely supportive of this kind of agenda, but have simply not found the right space and the right actions that they feel could be given to support women leaders while not themselves taking over the ownership and the direction. It's a very, very interesting new space that we're defining. We have men gender trainers in our amongst us, our core team, and we find that when men talk to men about gender issues, it's of course completely different dynamics, and men can really be honest without having to hide and say certain things that they feel women want to hear. Men can be honest with other men and talk about how it is as a man and how it is to be a masculine man to talk about gender equality and women's empowerment.
You are an American who knows very well the Asian context. You have lived there for a certain number of years. How could you describe the differences compared American and, let's say, Western world compared to the Asia in terms of women position and role?
In many ways, I think the gender issues are the same. The I don't want to say a problem in the West. Certainly women are in much better position in developed countries in Europe and North America. However, it's a little bit deceiving because it's not so obvious. So there are many women, particularly of a younger generation, who honestly believe that gender equality was a problem of the past, that their mothers took care of, and they no longer have to face these problems. Women of Asia do not have any such misunderstanding of the situation. In many Asian countries, the problems are so obvious that it's much easier to talk about gender equality and the lack of that than it is in countries of Europe and North America.
At least here in Italy, we all often hear about quotas. From your experience, do you think it's a good measure?
I think sometimes it's a first step and only a first step. It seems in some arenas it's so difficult for women to break into those spaces, politically important spaces, key positions in United Nations governments, United Nations organization in governments. If we do not, unfortunately, what experience has shown us in the history, if we do not create those spaces, men simply do not allow women to come up, either intentionally or often unintentionally. The spaces need to be created, but obviously just stopping there is not the answer, because there's a question not only of quantity but of quality. We have many women in positions who really are not gender responsive, gender sensitive women, who are not thinking about their use of that quota space to bring up other women and to bring up gender issues. So part of Wokan's work as well is to educate women about their responsibility and commitment to other women who are, you know, down the ladder or in a less privileged position.
And Mrs. Groom, would the world would be better with a woman UN Secretary General, a woman American, Indian, Chinese, Russian president?
If that yes, I mean, of course, I have to say it would bring a new perspective, particularly if she's gender sensitive, and particularly if women of the world and of her constituents would start to hold her accountable and start to demand that she not play the game in the same way that men have forever and ever, but that she use that opportunity to bring things in a new way. The question is for other women to hold these women leaders accountable.
Jeanette Gurung is Director of Women Organizing for Change in Agriculture and Natural Resource Management. Well, you can find more information about them on the web at WOCAM, that's WOCAM.org. And that concludes today's program. Thanks for listening. I'm Tracy McClure.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudator Jesus Christus.